Supposing that your world was suddenly turned upside down. Suppose that all your previous convictions, beliefs, and rock-solid certainties dissolved and were replaced by the contrary suppositions that you had formerly been deeply opposed to. Suppose that all you'd formerly worked for and striven for with all your energy suddenly came to seem like a deeply mistaken project. Suppose that an unexpected and shattering experience overturned your tenaciously held worldview and instead enlisted you in the service of all that you'd formerly opposed. This is what happened to Saul of Tarsus after his mystical encounter with the risen Christ at his Damascus Road conversion. The tenacious defender of the claims of traditional Judaism suddenly came to see the 614 precepts of the law, which Jews believed was a ladder between heaven and earth, as an instrument enlisted by sin and the devil to lead believers astray and to load burdens onto them that were completely unnecessary. Circumcision, the essential initiation rite into Jewish belonging and the people of God, would now be utterly rejected by Paul as neither required nor helpful for Gentile converts. And Jesus of Nazareth, whom he had formerly believed to be the betrayer of Jewish religion and the instigator of an insidiously heretical religious cult, became the center of his life. The relentless persecutor of the followers of the Jesus movement now became the most effective missionary and promoter of the Jesus movement. His success in evangelizing Gentiles, his founding of new churches throughout the Mediterranean world, and the depth of his theological thought in his letters to those churches make him, in some ways, the second founder of the Christian religion. What Paul had achieved was to persuade a small, struggling offshoot of the Jewish religion centered on Jesus the Messiah to accept Gentile believers on equal footing and to reorientate the focus of the infant church onto the Gentile mission. But this success had created a terrible dilemma for Paul, one that he wrestles with in the 11th chapter of the Epistle to the Romans. We were given a brief snippet of this anguished argument in last Sunday's epistle reading, and today we heard the paean of praise he directs to God at the end of what he supposes to be a solution to an intolerable dilemma that has been deeply distressing him. The problem is this: the success of his missionary endeavours with the Gentiles and his failure to win over many Jewish believers, together with his new conviction, the traditional Jewish religion has in many ways lost the plot, leaves him wondering and worrying about where this leaves the Jewish people. Are they fundamentally estranged from God, outside his favour and interest, no longer fit for purpose as a privileged people? Does God no longer dwell with them? How to make sense of this extraordinary and tragic situation? Paul throws out some ingenious arguments to meet the situation. In the time of the prophets, only a minority got the message and became the saving remnant that would reconstitute the true Israel after the disaster of the exile. This has happened again. Only a minority of the Jewish contemporaries of Jesus have believed in him and his followers, but that's enough to enable God's purposes to prevail. Furthermore, the resolute no of the majority of the Jewish people to the gospel message has created a wonderfully enriching opportunity for the Gentile world that many are embracing with both hands. God's astonishing tactical agility in coming up with unexpected ways of dealing with human rejection has brought about a situation where now the conversion of the entire Gentile world is a possibility. What is more, as the Gentile world turns to Christ, it may well be that the Jewish people will be provoked to jealousy. As they see the riches of God's grace being lavished on the outsiders, they may well want a piece of the action and finally get with the program. Then there's the question of God's timing as his mission acquires a worldwide scope. When the Gentile world becomes so saturated with the gospel message that, quote, the Gentiles have been admitted in full strength, then again, quoting, the whole of Israel will be saved as they finally tune into the good news and come on side with God's great initiative in the incarnation of his Son. In other words, the last act of human history, just before God rings down the curtain on the human story, will be the return of the Jewish people into saving belief in Jesus the Messiah as the fulfillment of Israel's hopes. Interestingly enough, the contemporary American Lutheran theologian Robert Jensen, who was the subject of my Master of Theology thesis, had a variation on this theme. Perhaps the fact that a son-in-law was Jewish and had been baptized by him had something to do with his interest in the subject. Jensen proposes that both Torah-observant Judaism is deficient in that it lacks the ingathered Gentile converts it was designed to attract, and that the Christian church is deficient in that it lacks the Torah-observant Jews who should be amongst its members. These twin deficiencies in these two faith communities, beloved of God, have been a detour in the way God plots out the salvation history of the human race. But just before the end, God will bring the two together as the last act in the human story. As Paul's argument draws to a close, he makes one thing crystal clear. God still loves the Jewish people. As he puts it, "But God's choice stands, and they are his friends for the sake of the patriarchs. For the gracious gifts of God and his calling are irrevocable." What Paul has done in the 11th chapter of the Epistle to the Romans is to construct a philosophy of history, an explanation of what history is all about from a God's eye point of view, and very impressive it is. Not all the arguments, though, stack up. You will have noticed, for instance, that the Jewish people have not been provoked to jealousy by the success of the Gentile mission in such a way as to want to acknowledge Jesus as the Messiah of Israel. But there are other parts of his argument that I didn't have time to go into, the wild olive graft proposal, for instance, that have become the basis of very fruitful interfaith dialogue between Christians and Jews, and that have formed the basis of one of the most promising documents of the Vatican II Council. But that's not the note I want to end on. I began by saying that Saul of Tarsus had been knocked sideways by his mystical encounter with the risen Jesus on the Damascus Road. So vivid and compelling had this experience been that it upended his priorities and made him something and someone quite different. Did you notice the description I put on the front cover of today's Pebble of the mystical experience that the 17th century French scientist and philosopher Blaise Pascal had of the Christian God over a two-hour period one evening? What is being described there is what is called an experience of the numinous, an intense awareness of the presence of God in a striking and compelling form. These are the kind of experiences that make the hairs on the back of your head stand up on end. These overwhelming experiences of the numinous are not cozy and comfortable. They've been described as the mysterium tremendum et fascinans. In other words, this is an encounter with the mystery that attracts, by which humans are irresistibly drawn to the glory, the beauty, the adorable quality, and the blessing, redeeming, and salvation-bringing power of God. Paul must have experienced this more than just once, as on the Damascus Road. From one of his letters, he describes himself as having been caught up into the seventh heaven. These experiences matter because they're a foretaste of what we shall all know in the life of the world to come, when we will be permitted to contemplate the very being of God in the shimmering depths of his wonderful existence. They are a reminder of what the Christian religion is all about: union with God. No wonder Paul ended the 11th chapter of the Epistle to the Romans by rhapsodizing this wondrous God. "O depth of wealth, wisdom, and knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments, how untraceable his ways. Who knows the mind of the Lord? Who has been his counselor? Who has ever made a gift to him to receive a gift in return? Source, guide, and goal of all that is, to him be glory forever. Amen."